I want to take a break from the podcast right now, and I want to give you a gift. And I want to do that to thank you for being a listener. I put my heart and soul into this podcast. I love interviewing today's experts, researchers, MDs, psychologists, sleep trainers, you name it. I hope you feel inspired to take care of yourselves and your families. And I just want to thank you for being a listener and hanging out with me. So the code PODCAST10 is going to give you a one-time $10 off code at kellylevesque.com, your next order of protein powder. You can either use that on my grass-fed beef isolate protein or on my new vegan chocho bean protein. Now, here's what I love about my protein powders. It's 3 ingredients or less. So we don't use fillers, emulsifiers, no fortified vitamins or minerals. It's easy to digest and naturally made without any enzymes or chemicals like hexane. So it's 3 ingredients. With my grass-fed beef isolate, that's 100% grass-fed beef, and it's made in the way that you would make bone broth. So just heat and water. And we dehydrate that end product to get that collagen-rich protein powder that your whole family can drink. It can be added to coffees, to smoothies, and you can get it in vanilla, chocolate, and unflavored. I want to point out that my vanilla and chocolate is made with organic vanilla bean, organic cacao, and the only sweetener used is organic monk fruit. We don't use any maltodextrin. Our monk fruit is 100% ground monk fruit, and it's organic. And with my vegan line, I'm so excited to have launched this and to have it out into the world. It's a regenerative bean from South America called the chocho bean. And the chocho bean is the most superior plant-based protein powder you can get your hands on, because not only is it a complete protein, but the process is made with heat and water only. They're crushed and soaked, and what that end product results in is an anti-nutrient-free protein powder. So you're not gonna have any lectins, phytates, or oxalates in your protein powder. Makes it super easy to digest, and it's really, really delicious and robust in cooking as well. So I love it if I want a thicker smoothie or a smoothie bowl. And I also love it in my baked goods, from my cookies to my muffins, pancakes, and breads. It's the perfect protein addition. So if you want to give either of these proteins a try, or you've already been purchasing these proteins and want to take advantage of this special deal, the code PODCAST10 is going to get you $10 off for being a listener here at the Be Well by Kelly podcast. So head to kellylevesque.com or bewellbykelly.com. Put the protein you'd like to purchase in your cart and use the code PODCAST10 for $10 off. Thank you, thank you, thank you for tuning in. Welcome back, everyone. Today's guest is my friend, Dr. Will Cole. He is the leading functional medicine expert who consults with people around the world via webcam locally in Pittsburgh. He specializes in clinically investigating underlying factors of chronic disease and customizing health programs for thyroid issues, autoimmune conditions, hormone dysfunctions, digestive disorders, and brain problems. He's written 2 phenomenally successful books, The Ketotarian and Inflammation Spectrum. I'm sure you've heard of these books if you probably already read them, but if you haven't, definitely jump on Amazon and get those delivered to your house, especially during quarantine. It's a perfect time to read all those books that you've had on your list. Dr. Will Cole and I met at the Mind Body Green Revitalized Conference out in Arizona a few years ago. We've been friends ever since. And he is actually the host of Goop Fellas. So Goop's podcast led by himself and our friend Seamus. So he's totally used to being on podcasts. He's an absolute pro. And I'm just really excited to pick his brain today. So, Will, welcome to the show.
Oh my goodness. This is about time that you have a podcast. You are born for this. So good at it.
Oh, geez. I don't know about that, but
it's true.
I sometimes listen back and I'm like, I just get so excited when I have guests on that I'm like, yes, that is so right. I hear what you're saying and I love it.
I'm so happy. Thank you for having me on the show.
Yeah, no, my pleasure. So, I mean, I have so many questions. I've obviously loved both of your books, but I'd love to go in first into how you work with clients and what disease states you're seeing most often in your practice.
Yeah. So like you had mentioned, my day job, my passion, my heart is really with consultations with patients and tracking their progress and really immersing myself in their case. So we run a concierge functional medicine practice. It's virtual. It's all online. We're based out of Pittsburgh, but our patients are all around the United States and in different, you know, Canada, Central and South America, Europe, all around the world. And it really, everything I do is an extension of them, my patients, an extension of what I see. And that's like the books are exactly that, just an extension of the things that I've seen and the research I've been really spending my time learning and studying. The predominance of my patients are people with autoimmunity. And that is very, it's far reaching as far as its implications and manifestations of how that looks in somebody's life. So it's estimated that 50 million Americans alone have an autoimmune disease, but millions more are somewhere on this autoimmune inflammation spectrum that I write about in both of the books, where they may not have a diagnosable ICD-10, like diagnosed autoimmune disease, but they're somewhere on this inflammation spectrum where they are having symptoms, they don't feel well, and they may have some markers that show an autoimmune component, maybe some thyroid antibodies, maybe an ANA being positive, but they don't fit all the criteria of conventional medicine. So I see the diagnosable people as well, but I see many people that have autoimmune components, pieces to the puzzle of why they feel the way that they do, but they are kind of largely falling through the cracks of conventional medicine where they aren't really given any solutions. They're kind of floundering, and many of them had to be their own doctor in many ways, their own health advocate, to immerse themselves in Dr. Google and find out all the answers. And they've got themselves to a certain level of, okay, I'm better than I once was, but they still aren't where they should be. And that's when they come to me and say, okay, what's missing from my health puzzle? These are complicated cases. These are complex cases many times, where it's beyond the basic stuff. And that's what I spend my time with. I'm consulting them online, and we are in providing them support and guidance in between visits as well, because real life happens for these people when they're not talking to a doctor. I mean, the decisions that have to be made and their symptom flare-ups that could happen in the early days happen in the in-between. So we need to provide them the responsiveness and the due diligence and the thoroughness that these people deserve, because the mainstream system largely is not set up for autoimmune people to be successful, because they're given steroids, they're given immunosuppressants and told, see you later. There's really no options beyond that, other than, you know, maybe some exceptions like IVIG, like certain therapies, but largely it's steroids and immunosuppressants, biologics, and that's it. So we're coming in and saying, look, no matter what's going on here, let's look at the components of why you feel the way that they do, feel the way that you do. And that's basically what my day job is spent on.
It reminds me of the Humira commercial, just like, yeah, here, slap this on it and let's deal with it. What are some of the symptoms that you're seeing people come in with that are indicators for you that there are potential underlying autoimmune issues, or, you know, a future of autoimmunity?
Yeah, so there's three stages that we talk about on this autoimmune inflammation spectrum specifically. There's silent autoimmunity, meaning if you ran labs, you may see some positive antibodies, but they're not noticing any symptoms. Their life's not being altered. It's not manifesting in any noticeable way. And then stage two is autoimmune reactivity, meaning they're having symptoms, they don't feel well, they have positive labs, but they don't fit the criteria of stage three, which is the autoimmune disease, meaning it fits all the criteria to be diagnosed officially. But by the time somebody's diagnosed with an autoimmune disease, on average, research estimates it's about 4 to 10 years prior to that diagnosis is when these things were brewing on this inflammation spectrum. So that's a long time. And these things don't happen overnight. When someone's diagnosed with MS or Hashimoto's disease or ulcerative colitis, that didn't happen the day before they were diagnosed. These things were brewing for 4 to 10 years, research estimates. So it depends on where they're at on this continuum of how this would be manifested. And there's a lot of different autoimmune diseases. There's over 100 different autoimmune diseases and an additional 40 or so above that 100 that have autoimmune components to them, but they're not considered full-blown autoimmune diseases. And I have no doubt that as researchers understand how certain diseases operate, we're going to find autoimmune components to many different health problems that are today not considered autoimmune. But it's when the immune system attacks certain parts of the body. So going back to that diagnosis statement earlier, for someone to be diagnosed with, let's say, Addison's disease, that's autoimmune adrenal disease, there has to be 90% destruction of the adrenal glands before it fits the criteria in conventional medicine to call it Addison's disease. Similar numbers to celiac disease with the villi in the gut, or MS with the myelin sheath, there has to be significant destruction before it shows up on an imaging study, or if it fits the criteria with labs to show, say, okay, this is who you are. So again, this larger continuum is a chronic continuum that needs to be addressed no matter where you're at on the spectrum. So the common symptoms that I see that may or may not have autoimmune components, because it's important to differentiate this here, is that you can have inflammation without having autoimmunity, but all autoimmunity is inflammatory in nature. So we see inflammatory problems that have no measurable autoimmune component to it. But there are obviously a lot of autoimmune people that are dealing with inflammation. So the common symptoms that I see are fatigue, and it's various amounts. If you're on one end of the inflammation spectrum, it's maybe mild fatigue. It's maybe things like anxiety, depression, but not extreme. It's just sort of mild anxiousness, like a background anxiousness, or just a lack of zest for life, or lack of motivation, a dullness mentally, and maybe weight loss resistance, like trouble losing weight. That's one end of the inflammation spectrum. That's not full-blown autoimmune disease, but it's inflammatory problems. All the way to the other end of the inflammation spectrum, which is overt chronic fatigue syndrome, it's other autoimmune diseases or mental health issues. And that's another part that I deal with a lot as far as brain health issues, is that in the West, we like to separate mental health from physical health. But the reality is mental health is physical health. Our brain is part of our body. And we need to understand, if we're going to be treating or addressing an organ like mental health, like brain health, we have to study it and understand what's going on in the brain, just like we would study the heart, or we would study the digestive system or the thyroid. The brain deserves attention on a physiological level. So we see a lot of people with anxiety attacks and panic attacks and fatigue and brain fog and these other mental health issues that have inflammatory components. And there's a whole field of research referred to as the cytokine model of cognitive function. Cytokines are pro-inflammatory cells. It's basically looking how inflammation impacts mental health, brain health. So those are the common sort of mental health issues that I see somewhere on that spectrum. And then digestive problems, of course, of bloating, people with SIBO, small intestinal bacterial overgrowth, people with histamine intolerances, people with these other food reactions, obviously intestinal permeability issues or leaky gut syndrome, and then hormonal problems, because autoimmune thyroiditis or Hashimoto's disease is the most common autoimmune disease. That's something that we see a lot as well. So it's definitely far-reaching. It can look different for different people, but those are some common things that I see.
So let's get into Hashimoto's a little bit, because that's a really interesting field, and you just mentioned that, or really interesting disease state, and you just mentioned it's the number one autoimmune disease that you see. It's something that I see very frequently, and a lot of times when I have a client come to me that's seen their doctor and their thyroid markers aren't where they're supposed to be, and they're on some form of like Synthroid or Nature's Throid, my first question and what piques my interest most is this actually a Hashimoto's diagnosis that has been misdiagnosed because there's been like a lack of testing? How would you test for Hashimoto's? What are you looking for? What are some of the symptoms? Are like, how could someone, if they didn't see their doctor and they might be being being treated with Synthroid, or how would they know?
Yeah, so you're so right about that. The thyroid's a great example of the different aspects of functional medicine comparing it to mainstream medicine. In the conventional setting, they're running the TSH, the thyroid stimulating hormone, and maybe T4, total T4, maybe free T4, because that's what they need to give someone, say, Synthroid or the levothyroxine, or if you have a more progressive doctor like Armour Thyroid or Nature Thyroid. The reality is, okay, that's just one aspect, one component of understanding someone's thyroid hormone physiology and pathways. So TSH is a pituitary hormone. It's a brain hormone that's supposed to tell the thyroid, hey, thyroid, work work more. So high TSH, thyroid stimulating hormone, it's the brain saying thyroid work more. It's higher. The brain is kind of screaming at the thyroid to work more. And then T4 is that predominant main form of the thyroid hormone. And it's largely inactive in the body. The brain uses some of it. So it's not that it's entirely inactive, but it's not the most bioavailable active form of the thyroid hormone. So then the thyroid has to be converted in the liver and in the gut. 80% of the thyroid hormone is converted in the liver and 20% of the thyroid hormone is converted in the gut. So you have to look at the total T3 and free T3. The free forms of these hormones, both free T3 and free T4, are what's getting on the thyroid receptor sites on the cells and activating whatever pathway that's supposed to be doing. So the thyroid is super important because every cell of our body has a thyroid receptor site. So it regulates everything from our hair health, like people that have low thyroid issues could have hair loss or thinning hair or brittle hair or nail issues, or they could have eyesight issues. They could have depression. They could have fatigue. They could have low libido. They could have digestive problems. They can feel cold in their hands and feet. The outer third of their eyebrows can be thinning. That's a sign, a clinical sign that the thyroid could be low. It regulates so much things in the body. So we have to look at all the thyroid hormones, but specific to Hashimoto's disease or autoimmune thyroiditis, autoimmune thyroid problems, you have to measure thyroid peroxidase antibody or TPO antibody and thyroglobulin antibody or TGA antibody. It's those two antibodies that have to be ran in the presence technically of a high TSH and some low deficit of low thyroid hormones to officially, conventionally diagnose somebody with Hashimoto's disease. But again, like I said, you're going to find some people with Hashimoto's that have maybe one antibody that's positive and some sluggishness of the thyroid, but it's within the lab's reference range. So that's the larger perspective in functional medicine. It's not just about running the right labs, like running the full thyroid panel, not just TSH and T4, looking at the total and the freeze of both T4 and T3, but it's also running the antibodies as well and something called reverse T3, which is this sort of analog of T3 that binds the thyroid receptor site that can cause low thyroid symptoms too. So it's, yes, it's running all those labs and being comprehensive diagnostically, but it's also the interpretation of those labs. Because the reference range on those labs, the labs, like if someone goes to their doctor's office or they go to LabCorp or Quest, you're going to have their number and they're going to have this reference range, this X to Y interval of numbers that they're being compared to. Well, that reference range is based on a statistical bell curve average of people who go to labs. People that predominantly go to labs, the population
sick.
Right. So there's a lot of people that aren't having these spectrum thyroid issues, to use that as an example, that are still quote unquote normal, but are still seeing the symptoms of these problems. So we have to look at T3 and the TSH and the thyroid antibodies through the lens of optimal health, not just being compared to that lab reference range. So the functional range, where your body is functioning the best, the optimal vibrant wellness range is typically a tighter range within that larger reference range that you'll see on that lab of where vibrant wellness resides. So that's important to know, that you can have these basic thyroid labs, or you can even ask your doctor to run these thyroid antibodies. But it's the interpretation of the lab that's important too. The reference ranges, you know, that we use in functional medicine, I have them on our website at drwillcole.com. You can look at other resources too in functional medicine to look at the optimal ranges, not just the lab's reference ranges.
And I think what you just said is optimal range for vibrant health. And that's basically what working with a functional MD is all about. It isn't about being bucketed into this big reference range and what I would maybe call the sick range. It's really honing in on making sure, like looking under the hood at a deeper level, finding the root cause and trying to get you to that vibrant health. And so that was like a perfect example. Thank you so much, Will.
Of course,
can you explain antibodies? Because sometimes I'll get going with someone on the podcast and then get questions like, okay, that's great, but I didn't understand the basics. Can you explain what antibodies are and in the body and how and why that's a marker for autoimmunity?
Sure. And it's important to know we're talking about the thyroid antibodies here, but you can have antibodies to just about every tissue in the body. And we can quantify that not just with Hashimoto's or autoimmune thyroid issues, but there are labs today where we can measure what they call predictive autoimmunity or autoimmune reactivity screens. These are blood tests to measure antibodies to neurological tissue for people that have neurological symptoms, or they have female hormone problems, to see those autoimmune components like, to things like endometriosis and adenomyosis, or joint issues like rheumatoid arthritis or fibromyalgia, musculoskeletal problems. So there's so many far-reaching aspects to measuring antibodies that people can look at that we run on labs. So what are antibodies? They are a product of our immune system. So in balance, they're not bad things. We all produce low, negligible levels of antibodies that are basically our body's cleaning system. Because what they are, they're not destruction molecules. They are flags for destruction. So if you have low levels of antibodies against the thyroid that are within the optimal functional range, that's your body's cleaning system. It's the immune system saying, hey, these are dead, maybe dysfunctional cells. They need to be sloughed off. They need to be clean and recycled, and normal, healthy autophagy pathways need to take place. There's going to be these immune-mediated pathways that are within the balance of human health, of homeostasis. So that's the same with inflammation. Inflammation is not inherently bad. It's a product of the immune system, just like antibodies, but it's about balance. You don't want too high inflammation. You don't want low inflammation. You want it just right when you need it. Same with the antibodies, which are a part of that immune-mediated response of which inflammation is a part of, where you want some production of antibodies. You want the immune system to clean up the body and keep you resilient and healthy on a cellular level, but you don't want excess destruction. So when you measure antibodies on a lab and you're seeing antibodies that are outside of maybe, let's say, the optimal range in the functional medicine world, but are also outside the lab's reference range too, what we're seeing here is that the immune system's tagging that tissue, let's use the thyroid as an example, is flagging it for the immune system to go attack it. So high thyroid antibodies in this example aren't necessarily directly proportional to the immune system destroying it, meaning you can have really high, hundreds and hundreds of thyroid antibodies on a lab, and it looks really bad because you're comparing it to the reference range. You're saying, whoa, like this is hundreds of points outside of the range for these thyroid antibodies. But that doesn't necessarily mean that the immune system's attacking it that much. But it does rule in an autoimmune component or Hashimoto's disease in this case. So we have to look at, I mean, ultrasound would be the one way to see how much of the immune system's destroying the thyroid. But on the blood lab, when we're looking at antibodies, we're just looking at, is the immune system behaving abnormally? Is the immune system overflagging certain parts of the body for destruction? And that's what autoimmune is. It's a lack of sense of self for the immune system, where the immune system then goes and tags the tissue, whether it's the thyroid or the myelin sheath in the brain or the gut, wherever you're talking about, it's tagging it abnormally and destroying it abnormally. And that's when that inflammation spectrum begins, because then the immune system upregulates inflammation against that tissue to attack it. And that's when you have those cytokine responses in the body, which can start to wear down and tear down and destroy certain parts of the body. And that's what autoimmunity is.
Wow. I love it. That was such a really, that was like the best explanation I've ever heard. So I appreciate that. What do you think the biggest culprits of this underlying inflammation and improper tagging of cells comes from?
Well, I think to back up the most that I can see, the way that I observe this, and I think about this way too often for the past 11 years, but the way that I would broadly say it, and we can get nitty gritty, but I think broadly, it's this larger mismatch between genetics and epigenetics. So what researchers are looking at, this isn't my opinion, this is just what researchers in this space are looking at, is that our genetics haven't changed in like 10,000 years, a long time. So 99% of our genetics have remained largely unchanged, but yet our world has changed very dramatically in a very short period of time when compared to the totality of human existence. So you look at the food supply and the destruction of our soil and the air supply, water supply, environmentally, just the world has changed so much in a very short period of time. And this growing destruction of the planet is largely awakening these genetic predispositions that have always been there. Again, our genetics haven't changed in 10,000 years. But why are autoimmune conditions being triggered like never before in human history? Well, it's this, according to researchers in this space, this mismatch, this evolutionary mismatch, if you will, between genetics and epigenetics, that the latent, like sleeping genetic predisposition has always been there, but it's being awoken like never before because of these environmental triggers. So that's the foods we're eating or foods we're not eating. It's the nutrient density of the food. It's the things that are sprayed and the quality of the food. It is stress levels, like chronic stressors. It is viral infections that, because the immune system's weakened, these opportunistic viral infections can trigger autoimmunity. Like Epstein-Barr virus has always been there. But now, because the immune system's so compromised already, the tipping point for many people's autoimmunity can be something like Epstein-Barr virus, the cytomegalovirus, or Lyme disease, or Lyme co-infections. We have lived in balance with these things for a long time. But because the gut is so impacted because of environmental problems and our food supply is so damaged and we're eating that stuff, these chronic infections can trigger these genetic predispositions for autoimmunity. And we have to deal with the chronic infections, of course, because then now they're living active in these people's immune systems because their immune system is not able to handle it like it should. So that's how you can measure Epstein-Barr virus for some people, and it will be an active response and they're not feeling bad at all. Or you can measure Lyme antibodies and they're positive in certain people's labs, but they feel fine. But for some people, those same viral or bacterial co-infections can trigger autoimmunity. So it's this dance between the environment, epigenetics, and someone's genetic predispositions for autoimmunity. So we have to look at things like chronic infections. We have to look at toxicity issues. Things like mold can trigger autoimmune problems, and someone's food, of course, and their sleep. Are they stressing their body out? All of these things need to be taken into consideration. And that's when a good health history comes into play. Like, what's even relevant for this person to start digging in from a lab standpoint to see what are their pieces to their puzzle? Because you can find like mold reactions for some people, but that's not relevant for everybody. So that's where I think it always starts with a good health history to see what labs are appropriate. But those are some things for people to consider that have been shown in the scientific literature to be triggers and perpetuators of autoimmunity.
Awesome. Yeah, I know. I feel like as a functional MD, if I were in your shoes, it would be, I'd be hard pressed not to want to run a million labs on people just to get a full picture plus a health history and understanding of like what they're dealing with on a personal level and where the inflammation lies, where potential autoimmunity lies, if there's mold, things of that nature. So I'm sure it takes practice. Yeah. really being surgical about which ones you're choosing.
It is. Yeah, it definitely is. And I think that's where it's that duality of functional medicine is the science and the art. Like the science of it is like reading, getting a good health history, really doing your due diligence on that thoroughness aspect of it. But the art of it is, okay, how do we make this practical? How do we make this realistic? What's actually going to change the treatment protocols? And are we just running labs for the sake of it? Like, I want to be comprehensive, but still be cost effective for these people, because these labs are largely not covered by insurance and you want to make it approachable and accessible for people.
Right. So outside of labs, what recommendations are you making when it comes to food and lifestyle and stress and things of that nature? And when we get into food, can we touch on things that have become like really buzzy in the nutrition space that quote unquote cause inflammation, like lectins and phytic acid and histamines and sulfites and all that stuff?
Sure. Yeah.
Okay, cool.
I'm totally down for all this stuff. I talk about this stuff. I'm so glad I get to talk about it with somebody else that talks about it as much as I do. So food is a powerful modulator of our health, right? Every food we eat either feeds inflammation or fights it. But because of bioindividuality, we're all created differently. And we all have different aspects to the baseline of our labs or our biochemistry. What works for one person may not be relevant for the next person. So it's important, going back to that duality of functional medicine, the science and the art. It's, yes, it's looking at labs. Yes, it's being thorough and getting the root components of what's going on here. But it's also, okay, how do we interplay this into their life and use real life as a lab in many ways, and what's working for them, what's not working for them? And I think that's someone, you know, So we have to look at that on an individual basis. So depending on the food, food protocol will be dependent on so many factors, both on a lab standpoint and what this person's schedule looks like. What's their personal preference? What do they like to eat? So we have to use food as medicine in a targeted, specific way. So we have patients that obviously across the board, they're going off of foods that are causing reactions in them. And that's really where the inflammation spectrum came to be, specifically my second book, because it was a lot of it was is just a methodologies that I've seen work for people with these autoimmune components and these inflammation issues of these food reactions in their body. So there's the core four foods. Those are the foods that research shows to be the four most likely foods to cause inflammation in people. So we have the simple people, like the people that, not the simple people, the people that are having, that are very bright, not simple, but are having, but very sharp people. Yeah. But they're people that maybe aren't having overt aggressive autoimmune diseases, but they still don't feel well. They maybe they have some fatigue, maybe they have some digestive problems, some inflammation, but they're lower on the inflammation spectrum. The core four are foods that you want to remove for a while. So that's grains, high omega-6 oils, like industrial seed oil, vegetable oil, canola oil, conventional dairy, and added sugar. Those are the four foods that are most likely to cause inflammation in most people. Again, bioindividuality, I don't have a problem if something's working for you and you feel fantastic, but we're going to go off of this four foods for 4 weeks. And then the eliminate track is a little bit more for people that are scoring higher on that inflammation spectrum. So I started the book out with a quiz to kind of go through the different aspects of the inflammation spectrum to see where they're at on that inflammation spectrum. And then they can determine what protocols are appropriate for them. The more aggressive one, or the one that's for people that are higher on the inflammation spectrum, is eliminate, which is the core four plus four more, or eight foods. And that's adding in nightshades, like removing those for a time. Those are peppers, tomatoes, eggplants, goji berries, white potatoes, nuts and seeds, legumes, and eggs. Again, most of those foods I do fine with, but somebody else isn't going to. So my job in the book, at least, is to find out what your body loves and what your body hates. So that's how I did it in the book. And that's how I implement a lot of these different protocols in the clinic as far as food is concerned. But obviously, when I'm seeing someone face-to-face online on a webcam, I can do things a lot more tailored that I can't encapsulate in the book. Like obviously you've written amazing books. You can't
write everything down.
Yeah, you can't write everything down. Like there's so many nuances and like tailorings and personalizations you can do. You cannot encapsulate it in a book. But the foundational aspects of what I've seen work for people, I put in the inflammation spectrum. So that's the food component. And then we have patients that are on carnivore diets. We have clean, well-formulated carnivore protocols, which is an ultimate elimination diet for a time for people that have extreme reactions. We have people on low histamine protocols. You have to tailor everything to low histamines. We have people that are on low oxalate protocols that you have to tailor it down. We have patients that are on low salicylate protocols. You have to tailor that down. So I mentioned this in the inflammation. We talked about histamines and salicylates, and we talk about oxalates. We talk about FODMAPs. We talk about all these different things. Not everybody has to do all those things. So that's where we typically come in functional medicine and say, okay, look, this is beyond the basics. Let's strategize food medicine beyond where we were at. Like we got to a certain level of improvement, but we have to kind of take it to the next level. So to the second part of your question, it's really about bioindividuality. Like I mentioned, like not everybody has to go and remove all these foods. But there are some people that would be benefited and it would behoove them for a while to remove things that are causing reactions to them. But the goal is to heal the gut, calm the immune system reactions. So you can slowly, and it may be very slowly, but slowly and methodically and systematically reintroduce these foods once you've calmed the immune system and regain some gut resilience. So like things like lectins or things like phytic acid or things like histamines, these are things that would have been foods for a long time. So I don't necessarily blame the foods, right? It's maybe partly the way we're preparing foods or the crossbreeding of certain foods or the hybridization or the genetic modification of certain foods where it's creating these reactions. But it's stressing out an already stressed out system. The gut is already irritated. The immune system's already reactive. So these foods, whereas in a normal person or a healthy person, they may be completely asymptomatic and be a great food medicine. But for this person that has a reactive system, removing them for a time while you actively heal the gut may be an appropriate step. And I would say that's definitely appropriate for a lot of our patients. But then we have to heal the underlying problem of what caused the problem in the first place. You can slowly reintroduce them. And there may not, there are obviously people that won't be able to eat everything under the sun, even when you heal the gut and calm things down because of different genetic variants. So I talk about in the book, like the endocannabinoid system or the ECS, there's certain gene variants that make certain people more susceptible to these food reactions. And the gut is rich with these CB1 receptors, these endocannabinoid system receptors. So they're just genetically, that immune genetic predisposition has been triggered. They are more prone to lectin reactions and these other food reactions where a lower lectin diet would be appropriate for them, even once you've healed the gut. And we can obviously mitigate the amount of lectins, which are the proteins in these plant foods like nuts and seeds, legumes, grains, other plant foods, by soaking them and sprouting them or using a pressure cooker and using these ways that can lower the amount of lectin content. So that it's not just about avoiding the food, it's about healing the gut and preparation of the foods. So those are all things that, these are the nuts and bolts, all the different variables that we have to consider for some people.
You know what I love is that you are so practical. Like starting with the core four and then going to the eliminate is, you're getting the biggest bang for your buck. I think a lot of times when people will jump on a very specific maybe a very specific anti-nutrient or a protein or a phytochemical that might cause a reaction in the body. And then they want to eliminate that without even starting with the basics. You know, that's, and the biggest offenders, I think you've really tailored it in a way where someone doesn't, maybe if they don't have the money to see a functional MD or have all these diagnostic tests done, you're basically giving people the keys to the kingdom to understand, okay, like, let's see how good you can feel. Cause that's always a real surprise to me. And I'm sure to you too, with your patients is some people just don't even realize how good they can feel or how bad they do feel at the time. They're just maybe stuck on one symptom or one thing that's bothering them, but really cleaning out their diet or pulling the biggest offenders can have just a major impact on their daily life.
Absolutely.
Cool. Well, what else when it comes to inflammation and stressors? Because you said so many things that I want to touch on, like CBD and endocannabinoid system. Like I'd love for you to touch on that and give us your thoughts on this booming industry. And then maybe touch on the other factors of our lifestyle that can cause inflammation on our blood tests.
Absolutely. Yeah. So the endocannabinoid system, it's one of the master regulatory systems of our immune system. So to look at autoimmunity, to look at inflammation and food reactions, you really have to in part understand or observe, measure the endocannabinoid system. So when people are taking CBD oil or they're having different like types of marijuana medicinally, it's working upon the endocannabinoid system. And it's the master regulator of our brain, our mood, our inflammation levels, our immune system. So people, a lot of the people that I see with patients, they have these gene variants. The research points to having sluggish aspects of their endocannabinoid system. So they may be more prone to these inflammatory problems or more prone to food reactions or more prone to mental health issues or autoimmunity. So these are things that you can't change your genetics. But again, our genetics have been around for 10,000 years the way that they are today. It's cleaning up your system so your genes can work the best they can work, and also supporting those genetic variants. So by knowing somebody has different gene variants, you can give your body more of bioavailable things that it's not making on its own. And I think that's largely why some people are seeing benefits from things like CBD oil, because it helps to give your body more therapeutic doses of things to support a healthy endocannabinoid system. So I think that that's promising. Obviously, it's the Wild West when it comes to all the CBD products out there. There's a lot of things that aren't pure, that aren't quality and reputable. So I think that third-party testing is appropriate. I think to know the source that you're getting and making sure that they are reputable. It's an emerging field. Every month, there's a new... I mean, I'm sure you get this too. The amount of CBD companies that reach out to us, right?
It's unbelievable. It's unbelievable.
It gives me a little anxiousness for them because to like break through in such a saturated market is like, whoa, I could not do what they do because there's so much competition right now. But you know, I think there are companies out there that are really leading the path. So I just look for good, great quality stuff. I think Prima is doing some really cool stuff. Christopher Gavigan is really wanting to lead the industry in having quality, having third-party testing, having reputable science-backed stuff. They're one that I like. Eaton Hemp is another one that, again, they're doing third-party testing. They have like hemp, other hemp products like hemp seed snacks and bars that I really like too. But they have CBD oil as well. So these are some companies that I've seen are really impressive as far as the research is concerned and being third-party testing. So I think that all of this has to be taken into consideration because these are all tools that we can use to modulate inflammation in a balanced way. Because again, inflammation is not inherently bad. We just want to have it balanced. It's the Goldilocks principle, not too high, not too low, but just right. And inflammation is definitely subject to that law.
So if someone wanted to try CBD, obviously they're looking for a reputable brand, but how would someone dose? And is there a specific time of day or, and then follow up question to that is you're mentioning like hemp products, like hemp protein bars or, you know, snacks. Is that working in the same way?
So you're going to get, when you're having hemp snacks, you're going to have some levels of CBD oils in there, but it's not going to be to the therapeutic doses. So how you're going to get to the therapeutic doses is typically a CBD product. It's not going to be the whole hemp. That's not going to get you the amount that you're going to see the changes in inflammation levels or the anxiety calming supporting mechanisms in the body. As far as doses are concerned, it depends on the product you're using. It depends on how much active compounds are in the solution or is it full spectrum or is it an isolate product? And then look at the milligrams. So read the dose on the bottle and start off low and slow, meaning that if you're extra sensitive, you may want to even consider going lower than what the lowest dosage on the bottle or whatever product you're using, because lean into it. It's a oil. So it's a fats compound. It takes time to build up in the body. And sometimes people that are certain, they have sensitivities to certain things, and that's a lot of my patients, it would benefit them to start off on the lower side of things and then slowly, incrementally work your way up. But you'll find there's certain brands, the reputable brands are going to have really detailed dosing recommendations. So that's another reason why I like these brands, because they're not just giving you a product and not educating the consumer. They're actually really showing you the research, showing you their specific product, their specific dosing recommendations. And those good companies are going to recommend low and slow so you can do it in a sustainable, safe way.
I love it. So we're using CBD as a tool. We're using our diet as a tool to lower inflammation. What can we do outside of what we're ingesting to lower inflammation?
That's such a great point. And that is the other wing of the inflammation spectrum. It's not just about food. And this is something that I know you're a major advocate of as well, is that you could eat really healthy foods. You could have the best healing foods under the sun. You'd be taking the best supplements under the sun. But if you're, you know, serving your body a big slice of stress every day, or you're scrolling through FOMO-inducing content on social media, that's going to be raising inflammation levels too. So it's these non-food stressors are something that I talk about in the inflammation spectrum just as much as the food inflammatory components too. So we look at stress in the book. We look at sleep or lack thereof. We look at social media addiction. We look at social isolation. We look at toxicity. All of these things need to be looked at as well, because mental health is physical health. Your thoughts and emotions influence your biochemistry. Our thoughts and emotions influence inflammation levels and our immune system. So this isn't about being perfect. This isn't about being like this, saint or monk overnight. This is about really leaning into these practices in a practical way. Like you said, a tool. And we bring tools into the book, like mindfulness meditation, like getting out in nature, and the research coming out of South Korea and Japan and forest bathing, like really low cost stuff to deal with stress, to deal with the pang, the dysfunctional aspects of modernity, the things of our modern life that are a mismatch between our genetics that are feeding into the stress inflammation cycle that's impacting our health. Because I see many patients, they get the food down pretty good, but it's these non-food inflammers that are really the underlying saboteurs that need to be addressed just as much as the food.
Forest bathing sounds divine. That's all I want right now. I mean, I think it's funny that we grow up in nature, or some of us do. Like, I grew up around nature, running trails in high school during PE, like in horse country and hills, and then moved myself to the city for school. And I've been here ever since. And now, having a son, that's all I want, is just get me back to nature. I'm constantly going to the beach, but I really just need space, because it's almost like you feel like you can't breathe, especially with the increased stressors of social media and constant workflow, constant communication, like the onslaught of all of that.
Absolutely. No, it's absolutely true. And a lot of this stuff, like I said, are low cost, free things that maybe people, like you said, they intellectually know or they intuitively know, but they don't really put it into practice. So it's bringing these things and cultivating sustainable practices, because we have to take care of our mental health. And again, in turn, that is going to impact our physical health.
Totally. So now I'm interested to know a little bit more about you personally. What does day in the life of Dr. Will Cole look like? And you can throw in, like, if it was a perfect day, or not quote unquote perfect, because no one has a perfect day, but like if you could design a fabulous day, what might that look like?
All right. So this is going to be good. I'm a pretty simple guy, and I do mean it with me. I'm pretty like it just very easygoing. I like routines. This is basically a typical day for me. And for people that know the Enneagrams, you know Enneagrams? The like personality?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I'm, for any Enneagram super fan out there, I'm a 5 wing 6, which means like the 5 is like the owl, like observer, wants to collect wisdom and knowledge and information and observe stuff.
Sounds about right.
Yeah. And the 6 is like slightly anxious and like a deer. So I'm like, if an owl and a deer had a baby, that would be me. So I wake up in the morning. I typically, I fast in the morning. So I'll do time restricted feeding in the morning, and I come to the clinic. I have like a different tea. I drink Peak tea pretty much every day. I have no affiliation with Peak other than they're great people and my friends, but I have no financial connection with them. They are like these little tea.
The satchels, the little packets that
exactly.
dissolve.
Exactly.
They're really high in like polyphenols. They're like the highest concentration of, oh, look at you.
So I'm doing that in the morning. I typically would have Earl Grey tea, and Peak Tea knows I like Earl Grey tea because they always keep me stocked up with Earl Grey tea. So thank you, Peak Tea. But I like Earl Grey tea because it's the black tea. So it has a little caffeine, had, like you said, tons of polyphenols. And you can get any Earl Grey tea. So, I mean, really any good quality Earl Grey tea. I just like the high polyphenol content of this type of tea. And it dissolves right in the water. So you get, instead of it steeping through a bag, you can get it right into the water. Anyways, it's the bergamot, which is the citrus from Calabria in Italy. Bergamot is typically in Earl Grey tea. And there's studies to show that it supports autophagy pathways, which is just like cellular recycling pathways in the body, which is, think of it as like anti-aging, anti-disease, sort of self-cleaning, like spring cleaning pathways of the body. Fasting does that too.
So yeah, I was going to say, it's like Dr. Longo's research. It's like all from that. It's like you can either fast for 4 days and start this process, or you can drink Will's Peak tea.
I drink Earl Grey tea. I'll do time-restricted feeding until like noon. And then I eat a very ketotarian like food day. So it's a mostly plant-based ketogenic way of eating that I talk all about in my first book. So it's pescatarian keto, vegetarian keto, and vegan keto. Variety of foods, all yummy, delicious stuff. So I am fat adapted. So I could have blend intermittent fasting with a ketotarian way of eating. But I do a cyclical ketotarian eating. So I'll do a couple days in ketosis and then I'll have sweet potato fries or a fruit smoothie and then I go back into ketosis. So it's a tool like you advocate for so brilliantly. That's what I do. So I just eat intuitively, mostly plant-based keto, and then I'll cycle out of it with some healthy, clean carbs, or I'll have grass-fed beef when I want to. So it's not punitive in that way, and I kind of just eat intuitively. That's my food stuff. But then I'm consulting patients, so it is very much the same thing. So from 8:15 in the morning, we have a case review meeting. So a meeting with my team, and we start the morning off as a team with prayer and meditation, just like praying for these people that we can be there for them in the way that they need to be and that God can use us in a positive way for these people. And then we deal with the clinical stuff too. So we're like, okay, what do they need? What's the latest lab look like? So we're all immersing ourselves in unity for these people. And then we hit the ground running from 9 a.m. to 6 p.m. We are consulting patients online. So that's my typical day. And then I come home and hang out with my awesome kids and my wife. So I have a 13-year-old son, a 10-year-old daughter. And I mentioned before we started recording, they're homeschooled. So they may have some things left over that I help them with. Maybe not. Maybe we just hang out. And we have two dogs, hang out with those. And we just have a chill life. And that's repeat Monday through Friday, basically what we do. And then the weekend's like a chill day for me. Because I'm an Enneagram 5-wing-6, I would just like to chill and like read a book, sit outside, like get some sunlight and hang out with some friends in the evening. That would be like a good non-work day for me.
It makes my heart so happy that you care so deeply for your patients and that you start your day with a meeting around your cases, really just like holding space for them, because I think that completely changes the way you work with your patients. And that's why I trust you so much with my clients is there isn't a lot for a lot of people, there isn't the space to do that. And that's just, it's a really beautiful part of your practice. So thank you for that. That's, and I'm sure, you know, I know all your patients appreciate it too. Your days sound very chill. They sound really, really calming and probably inflammation squelching type of days.
Pretty much. I have to practice what I teach. Otherwise, what is this all for, you know?
Right. Exactly. Okay. Well, before we end this podcast, I'd love to know what body love means to you.
Wow. So something that I talk about a lot as a mantra in the clinic that is very much body love compliant and infused with body love awareness is you can't heal a body you hate. And I find a lot of times people, they try to stress and shame and obsess their way into wellness. And I know that you and I have talked about this at length, this orthorexia and this byproduct out of the wellness community unintentionally has brought a lot of people this fear and anxiety around food. And it's not helpful. So I think that what body love means to me is really bringing a grace and lightness into wellness, maybe for the first time in someone's life, but at least bringing it back, because sustainable wellness is born out of that. Because you can only stress and obsess your way into a program or a diet for so long, and then it's going to add to your pile of things that have failed you. So I think that truly sustainable wellness is born out of realizing your intrinsic worth, the valuable creation that you are. Because when somebody sees themselves for this awesome, priceless, creation, how is that going to impact the foods that they eat? How is that going to impact the movement that they do or the things they're filling their heart and mind with on social media? How is that going to impact the way that they live? And it's going to really shift it to quality, because the analogy that I use in the book is if someone sees themselves as a Tesla versus like an old beat up car, how is that going to impact how they treat themselves? And many people don't realize that they're a Tesla and they were created for greatness. And they're living their life out of this sort of self-hate, and that's really not bringing them any of the fruits that they want.
That's so beautiful. Premium gasoline only.
Yes. Or electric.
Or electric. Yeah, that's right. That's so true. It's beautiful. It really is, because you're connecting them to their why, which I love. It's like, why are you here? It isn't to obsess over the food that you're putting in your body. It isn't to force it. It's to really, really get to know yourself and take care of yourself the way you deserve.
Absolutely.
Beautiful. Well, thank you so much for your time today. This is absolutely one of my favorite podcasts. I'm lucky to call you a friend and lucky to have you in my practice and as a support tool for my clients. And and just thank you for putting all of the work into both of your books. They are two of my absolute favorites. I think if I were to create a bookshelf for people, yours would be on the shelf. So I appreciate you spending so much time doing that and putting so much good into the world on Goopfellas. It's been fun. It's been a fun listen over there as well. So where can people find you? Where can they follow along? And how can they take better care of themselves?
Thank you so much. And thank you so much for the kind words. And I feel the same way about you. You're doing awesome things. And I'm so thankful that we can be in such an awesome time in human history together, like doing things that are so synergistic together for people and helping them. So I'm very, very, very grateful for you. Everybody can get information about what I do at drwillcole.com. That's drwillcole.com. Same on Instagram, I'm at Dr. Will Cole. Goopfellas podcast, it's goop.com/goopfellas. That's where they can get all the information.
Great. And your books are sold on Amazon or in all major retailers. That's Ketotarian and Inflammation Spectrum for you guys listening out there. I'll have links to all of Will's social and his website and both of the books in the show notes. And I believe I saw that you can take the Inflammation Spectrum quiz on his website as well. So definitely go take a look at that. Well, it was an absolute pleasure, you owl.
Owl dear baby.
I seriously love you. Have a beautiful day.
Love you too.
Enjoy your quarantine. Like, lean into those babies and 10 and 13, not necessarily total babies.
They're anymore, my big babies.
They're your big babies. Yeah. we'll talk soon, friend. I appreciate you.
Talk soon.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to Be Well by Kelly. Please subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. Learn more at bewellbykelly.com and follow me on Instagram at bewellbykelly. I would love if you picked up my books, Body Love and Body Love Every Day. They're sold on Amazon and at all major booksellers.